In this episode, you'll learn why helping people change is hard and get some inconvenient, uncomfortable, but absolutely essential truths to help you update your change operating system so you navigate and lead change successfully.
Welcome to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, a podcast helping human-centered leaders master communication to accelerate your team's performance, reduce stress, and build a career with the respect and influence you deserve. I'm your host, David Dye, president of Let's Grow Leaders.
Hey, welcome to the show. Today, we're talking about change. And after all, as a leader, you are in the change business. And what is leadership? It's how do we work together so tomorrow's better than today? That's change. And you're going to get specific suggestions to help you master the new rules of change so you can build that future together with your people more efficiently with less overwhelm, become a leader known for successful transformation, and build your career in an ever-changing world. And here to help us do all of that, I'm very happy to be able to introduce you to a friend of Let's Grow Leaders, known each other for a couple of years, Michael Bungay Stanier. And if you recognize that name, it's because Michael wrote, and not everyone can say a book of the century, Michael wrote the business coaching book of the century, The Coaching Habit. Why do we call it that? Because it has sold millions of copies. If you have not read it, you're missing out. You need to read that. But it's actually not our topic today. He's also written other books, and there's a good one out there, How to Work with Almost Anyone, and many others. And he's the host of the Change Signal podcast. And just most recently, now a masterclass faculty member teaching masterclass executive for you senior leaders. Michael, welcome to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul.
David, thank you. That's a great introduction. Let's try not to disappoint people now.
we'll try.
Set me up in a great way.
You know, the thing is, it's easy to do introductions when they're all true. So no, I really do appreciate you being here. So
we've been planning on this for ages. So I'm glad
it has been a minute. Yeah. As you can imagine, listener, Michael's schedule is pretty busy. You know my schedule, so it's taken us a while to be here, but we're jazzed to do it. So Michael, we're talking about change and. Yeah. So let's just dive in. I promised up front, what makes change hard? And, you know, people always say, people don't like change. What is it about change that makes it so challenging for leaders today?
Well, the first is it's always been challenging, and it seems to be getting harder and faster and more ubiquitous and more overwhelming. Just to kind of give you some statistics from the people who sell you change programs. So these are people who've got a vested interest in actually trying to say we do a good job. 40 years ago, McKinsey, one of the big consultancies, was like, 70% of all change initiatives fail, which sounds pretty bad. But that actually sounds pretty good compared to what Bain are saying, which is like 85% of all change, 88% of all change initiatives fails. Unless, of course, you're talking digital transformation. In that case, Bain says 95% of digital transformations fail. Oh, so my. That all sounds bad. Here's some context around that. Less than 10 years ago, employees would have expected to experience about 2 change initiatives per year. Nowadays, it's up to 10 and climbing. The willingness of employees to go through change has halved from about 75% to about 35%. And the competency of leaders feeling that they can lead change is self-reported at about 12%. So, and like, it's all hard. Like, people don't know how to lead. People don't want to be led. People don't want to go through change. And yet change is ever increasing and the failure rate is ever increasing. So you've set this up to say, look, if you're a leader and you want tomorrow to be different from today, know that the winds are against you. And whatever the old wisdom was that you've taken on to think about change, I just don't think it seems to work anymore. So we've got to figure out some new rules.
So true. And I think one of the things that you just highlighted there, I want to kind of double click, tap into here. And it's made me think of 2 different clients this week. One is a U.S. domestic company. The other is global. And both of them this week talking with me about change in their organizations and frustrations and challenges and so forth. And one of the elements there is exactly that statistic you just mentioned about the frequency of significant change initiatives. Right. And I mean, we are talking with one of them. They said, look, honestly, it has been a traumatic, this is actual trauma level of change. Right. Some of it imposed externally, some of it chosen internally, but all of it having happened. And so, yeah, now no one wants to do change again, not for a good long time. So let's just start with this conversation about frequency.
Well, I mean, when I started in the game, which was probably 30 years ago, maybe even a bit longer, because I'm suddenly an old person, I just remember us going, we're going to launch a change project, and we'd launch it, and we'd run it, and then we'd finish it, and we go, ta-da, and we go back to business as usual. And I think now it's almost not even worth counting how many change initiatives are happening. You just need to say change is part of everyday business. It is just part of what goes on. And rather than going, oh, every now and then we've got to ready ourselves for a change initiative, I think partly you have to be saying, on an ongoing basis, we need to be building capacity at a leadership and an employee level to surf, manage, navigate, survive change. It can't be a, oh, they're doing another change project to us again. It's just, oh, no, change is part of the job description. It's not separate from the job description.
And so and it sounds like that might be one of the mindsets that we just fundamentally have to address in this age. I mean, and there's so many reasons for business environment, artificial intelligence. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah.
And we're also talking about human beings here. And
right.
At the same time, while we need to say, okay, change is always has been on some level, the ground's always eroding. You're always responding to change. Evolution's real, right? We all know horse and buggy whips and all that kind of thing. But there's a fundamental reality to helping people know what they're supposed to be doing today and having that clarity that's at odds with, if I don't know how to succeed in what I'm doing today, then I'm really frustrated. So
yeah.
How are you finding successful leaders navigating that challenge?
I think the ones that are managing change best are focused on three things. And I think two of them will be surprising to the folks listening in. The third one, perhaps less surprising. And the first thing that they're focused on is what I call distributed agency, meaning they realize that what they're looking to do if they're responsible for change is to increase the capacity and the willingness of people to say, I'm up for participating in change. Now, under that umbrella of distributed agency, there's a lot of things. And you know, one of them, for instance, is, do you know how to nurture your team and those around you to get through what's going on so that you are fueled? But also it's like, do you know how to run small experiments? That's one of the key things around how change works, because, you know, talking to like lots of really smart people on this Change Signal podcast, and a recurring theme, one that surprised me a little, I have to say, was the number of people go, you can't have a project and a plan and roll out the big experiment from the top of the house. You have to push down what's hoped for in the change initiative or the way everything's evolving and growing, and encourage people to run small experiments to figure out the way forward. Yeah. And a small experiment means you don't go, we've got one idea and we're just going to do it until we either succeed or die. It's, we're going to kind of feel our way to the next place, get some data, figure out what that tells us, what to do more of and what to do less of and what to amplify, and then design a way forward into the next iteration. Now, to do that, you have to build the capacity at an individual and a team and an organizational level to understand small experiments generate small failures and small successes, but small failures as well. And so building a capacity for failure. So I think that's one broad area, which is
distributed agency. I mean, this is brilliant. And it's so vital. I saw it today. I don't know if you posted it today on LinkedIn. You were talking about this ability to receive feedback on these experiments and what we're learning from them and so forth. And there's two things that you just said in distributed agency, and I want to tap into these for listeners. Sure. First is, when you're talking about distributed agency, you're talking about ownership. And one of the resistances that people have to change is when it's done to them, as opposed to when they have some ownership and it's done with them. I am a part of this. I have agency here. So just psychologically, that's huge.
But it's also tricky. Because I'm like, if you're responsible for change, you're like, no, I totally buy into doing change with people, not doing change to people. But damn it, why won't they do the thing that I want them to do? This is the paradox at the heart of empowerment, because empowerment is a kind of sister word to agency. Mm-hmm. There are few people in the world who will explicitly say, I am against empowerment. I don't believe in empowerment. You're not going to see anybody sticking up their hand going, I'm an anti-empowerment sort of gal. And the act of empowerment typically means you giving up some of your power and control and certainty and authority and status and giving it to that other person. So the actual moment of empowerment can be quite difficult, quite painful, quite kind of resistant. And this, you know, this flows through to this whole idea of agency, which is like, you know, so the prizes and punishments of doing change with people, because every choice you have has prizes and punishments. The prize is agency, buy-in, scalability, spreadability. The punishment is lack of control, increased failure, some random stuff happening that you don't fully understand, people doing it not the way that you'd like them to be doing it, a sense of powerlessness at times. And all of this is true. So,
and some of those are internal things that we have to work through as a leader ourselves and come to terms with. And just like any other kind of empowerment, if we're talking about delegating or anything else, there's also, you can mitigate some of those by doing, and you've used this word several times already, or this phrase, building capacity. We actually can teach people how to navigate, how to run the small experiments you're talking about. What are the criteria we're trying to fulfill? How do we learn from these? We can do all of that to help people navigate these things.
Well, that's actually a perfect segue to the second of the big levers that I think people should be kind of obsessing about. So should we go there?
Yeah, let's go there.
Okay, so I think the second thing that people need to be thinking about is, what is our organizational capacity for change? We need real capacity at an organizational level, because too often the waves of change feel like, and I'm mixing my metaphors terribly here, but feel like you're trying to pour water into a full glass. You're like, everybody is flat chat. Everybody is overwhelmed. Everybody has too much on their plate right now. And we'll just add the change on top of that. Add the expectation that you will help us, that we'll do change together, on top of all your other stuff that you have to be doing, which is already too much. Now, ironically, because AI is such a disruptive force for most of us, we're all going, oh my goodness, what's happening? But one of the things that AI might be doing is freeing up capacity, because, you know, you're figuring out how to get agents and the like to do work for you. And the temptation is, oh good, we can give people more work because they've got agents doing other work for them. But I think it would be a very interesting question to sit with the idea of, does that allow you to free up capacity at an organizational level to actually do change? Because, you know, sometimes it's like fingers in the air, la, 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 we'll pretend we have capacity. Sometimes the better change projects kind of carve out capacity. They carve out time and money manpower, people power to do stuff. But I think the organizations that are having most success just go, we need to have ongoing real capacity for us to have working through the change part of it built into what's happening throughout an organization.
Yeah. And, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about the number of kind of headline articles we see about some companies. And I've had some of these conversations internally too, where, let's just take AI change for a moment, that comes out as a mandate of, we're cutting a third of our force. Replace that work with AI, figure it out. And there's no training. There's none of the capacity. Right. There's no mini experiments along the way to be sure. Right? And so these elements, and so you're undermining yourself, as opposed to what you're talking about, which is, I'm just thinking about, for, I think every organization right now, this is, there's change initiatives regarding artificial intelligence in some fashion. So if nothing else, here's an opportunity for us to be practicing these things and saying, okay, what are the criteria that I'm trying to meet? What is, change is ongoing, but then how are we going to build capacity in that distributed agency by doing some equipping building capacity individually at the team level? And then what are we checking for? And for both of the first and second one that you talked about, the distributed agency doing the small experiments and the organizational capacity, an element in both of those is the ability to learn from feedback. And exactly. I want to dial in on that too, Michael, because I think that's another reason that people resist change. And you can tell me if I'm off track here, but what I mean by that is, okay, so a change initiative gets rolled out. And one of the concerns from the people always doing the work is, oh, this isn't going to work. Well, if there's no way to report back what's working and what's not working, that person is naturally disincentivized to embrace and take action. But if there is a way for me to report, oh, here's what I'm seeing, here's what we're learning, here's what's working, here's what's not working the way we hope, and we can do something with that, now they've again got agency. Now we're getting these feedback systems to build a better outcome. So at least that's the way that I view it. I'm curious how you see
it. Yeah, I like it. And I like the way, I mean, you're using feedback. The way I'm hearing you use that as data, you're getting data
absolutely
from the thing. So
less
I'm going to give you feedback as an individual to improve, although that could be part of it, but it's more like I'm trying some stuff out and the system's telling me something about what works and what doesn't work around that, which is allowing me to make some next phase decisions around what my next steps are. Now, if you have an organization that says we're interested in all the data so we can make smarter decisions, fantastic. If you're an organization that says we're interested in all the data except all the bad data, because that means you're failing, so please only tell us the good data, then you find yourself in a quandary. And there are quite a lot of organizations that are like that in deed, if not in word.
Have you been listening to the podcast and getting value from the show? If so, I've got a small favor to ask, because over the next few months, we're going to be making some changes to better serve you. Now, I could keep creating episodes based on what I think would be most helpful, but I would much rather get this right. So instead of guessing, I want to understand where you are right now and the real challenges you, your organization, and your team are facing. That's why I've put together a very short 90-second survey. It'll help me better understand you and how I can serve you at a much higher level. And as a thank you, the first 30 people who complete it will receive a free signed copy of one of our books. To take part, just go to the show notes and click the link titled Leadership Survey. Or you can go directly to letsgrowleaders.com/podsurvey. PODSURVEY. It'll take less than 2 minutes. I really appreciate your input. It will genuinely help shape the future of the show. So what have you found to be, from a leadership perspective, just starting at the basic level, get really practical here, how do we start to build that ability to take in the data that might be inconvenient or uncomfortable, but absolutely valuable for helping us build the future we want?
Well, it's hard. I'm just going to say that. It's like, I was about to go, let me offer up a, you know, single, simple answer to that. That is both
we like
simple,
to keep it real,
powerful, but wrong. Yeah. It is hard because there is a way that it needs to happen at individual levels, because we all know that at a team level, a great influence of a team level is the person who leads that team. So if she says, I am up for this and I want to hear the data and I don't freak out when the data is bad and I learn how to adjust and I give people the capacity to do that, then that happens at that level. But it's also clear that if there are people in the C-suite who aren't like that, then you may build these small subcultures, but there's no way that the whole culture of the organization shifts. So in some ways, this takes the spotlight up to what we see in, you know, top level leadership, whether that's just at the C-suite or plus one or however far you want to go. And I think that C-suite, part of what they're role modeling are a willingness to play a long game, which feels very hard when you're driven by quarter results and AI is making everything feel like I've got my pants on fire. But there's a kind of a capacity to say, look, here's a strategic goal that we have, and we're going to keep coming back to that singular vision. The second thing that the C-suite wants to do, or that leadership team needs to do, is actually create a vision for change that has a compellingness to it, and a resonance. And often they come up with pretty terrible visions, like, oh, we want to increase the thing by 5% and decrease the other thing by 5%. And I'm like, there's literally nobody in this organization who cares about that, apart from the six people whose bonuses are dependent upon it. So there's a way that that gets in the way. And then the third thing I think this upper echelon of leadership can do is to relentlessly simplify things for people. Because, you know, and I'm thinking of people like Lydie Klotz's book, Subtract. You know, human beings are typically lousy at removing stuff and simplifying stuff. You know, it's like, let's add. When in doubt, add some more. And so even as things get freed up with AI or perhaps in some other way, the greediness of that leadership is like, okay, let's add some stuff to this. But talking to some of the leaders I really respect, you can really see they're like, we're just trying to keep it simple. We're trying to remove barriers. We're trying to get rid of the stuff that gets in the way of our people being their best, doing their stuff, having agency, all of that.
And this goes to that second category you're talking about organizational capacity, because what you're really talking about is margin. Correct. We have to have margin. We have to have respondability, which means there's time in the day, there's ability to absorb. And, you know, and this is not all just, oh, some, you know, greedy board or senior leader who's like, we have to pinch every minute that people have. There's a natural ratcheting effect. You know, Seth Godin calls it that ratchet effect, right? Where, you know, and it happened to us, okay, back in the old days, your hand wrote letters. Now we got email. And just the expectation creep of how many messages I'm going to be able to send. And then we get texting, right? And Slack and everything. And so that expectation creep just happens. If we don't intentionally work against that to create the margin you're talking about and say, okay, this has, once we get past the learning curve of it, and I think so many people are still on the learning curve, but maybe agency, AI agency does create some of that. Okay, how do we be intentional about maintaining that margin that it has created so that we can deploy that to deal with ongoing, ever-increasing change that you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, I'm still handwriting replies to all of my emails and Slacks, and I am so far behind. You would not believe it. It's killing me.
Oh, my goodness. That will give me nightmares tonight if I even think about doing that. Oh, thanks for that. You've just tortured my dreams. Appreciate that, Michael. All right. Well, hey, we're talking with Michael Bungay Stanier. The podcast is the Change Signal Podcast. If you love what we're talking about, as I do, I just encourage you to check this out. Michael talks about it with so many brilliant thinkers and leaders. And we're not done yet, but I want to give a chance for this third area. So we started with distributed agency, building organizational capacity. What is the
real capacity? The third is technical excellence. And by that, I mean technical excellence of some of the drivers of change. And I would put things in there, including project management and marketing and communications and kind of training and learning and development. And these are all the tools that have traditionally used by change teams to make stuff happen, you know, make a compelling case, you know, reach out to people, move them with the marketing, engage in behavior change through the training, manage the project through the project management. And it's done really badly in lots of organizations still. You know, if you're thinking to yourself, what's the 2026 standard of what marketing is? Then you go, look, here's what you're competing with. You're competing with TikTok. You're competing with Netflix. You are competing with an awareness from Silicon Valley and elsewhere around just what it takes to grab people's attention. Like, at the bare minimum, if you are writing to try and make change happen, you need to be an excellent copywriter, or you need to know an excellent copywriter and hire that person, because people find it hard to read. And if you write a boring email, I mean, I've just talked to a client about this. doing a big culture change initiative. It's very exciting. It's very non-trivial. It's this big thing. And he sent out this email kind of inviting people in. And it was so disappointing. It was so disappointing. It felt, you know, a little too rah-rah, a little too self-centered on the organization. I didn't really reflect the understanding of what people were going through and what they were excited about and what they were afraid of. Didn't really have a call to action. And I know all of that is there because we're working closely enough with them to kind of figure that out. And I was like, oh, man. I mean, even if you'd just taken that email and gone, rewrite this like a brilliant copywriter so it becomes a compelling call to action and engagement in this change initiative, it would have been, you know, X times better.
And if you're talking to a large enough organization, they have that competency in the company because they use it on the external facing communications, right? And I mean, it's just amazing to me how often as organizations, as leaders, we'll do that. We'll use external facing. And when we're talking to our customer or to the world, you know, we make it about them. And then as soon as we talk internally, oh, we make it about, it's not about the person we're talking to, where we know the techniques and skills, we're not always applying them internally or to change management.
Yeah. I mean, if you imagine a spectrum of a deliverability against these technical skills, you know, it goes from the bottom end of the spectrum, which is like, it's held together by duct tape and rust. Maybe further up the spectrum, you're like, it's really good 2013 specs. You know, it was like, it was fine 13 years ago. We just haven't managed to move beyond any legacy systems or thinking or mindset since then. You know, further up the spectrum still, it's like, it's okay, we're shoving AI into everything that we can, even though we're doing it in an ad hoc random way. But, you know, what you're striving for is a best-in-class experience of learning and development or project management. And there are so many ways that those are dragged down to being mediocre. Mm-hmm. And even as you're doing those two harder things, I think harder because they're, you know, creating agency across an organization is tricky. Building real capacity into your organization is tricky. But the call to action for people who are like connected to the mechanics of the change, you have to be delivering your stuff at a real level of excellence.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So that's our third one. So we started with distributed agency, organization building true organizational capacity.
Yeah.
And then the technical excellence in terms of your project management, your marketing, your learning and development, all of the different systems that we have that they're really.
And that's what I'm calling, you know, my language for this is modern change mastery. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a sense that what was around 10 or 20 or 40 years ago just isn't fit for purpose anymore.
Yeah.
And mastery doesn't mean a completion of this. It's an understanding of what you're striving for now, what's required for modern change in 2026 and beyond.
So Michael, with all of that, we've got just a couple minutes left, and I want to, we've been talking to our senior leader listeners who might be driving at some of the people responsible for the organizational things at that level. I want to go one level down to our middle level leaders.
Yeah.
If we have many listening, because I know often that they are in that translator role, they're having to drive these initiatives and so forth. And I'm just going to dive into that data piece that we talked about. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a way to do it. Even if the senior leader hasn't been eminently approachable in terms of how they model receptivity to data that might not fit their mold, there is still a way for leaders at that middle manager, as they're collecting data, as they're getting it, to share it in a way that is supportive and isn't combative and so forth.
Exactly.
Have you seen any, and I've got my own, of course, thoughts on that, but I'm curious what you've seen out there in terms of our approaches for our middle managers who are listening going, yeah, I want this to succeed and I need to get this data across to help that happen.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I love that we're going there, because actually when you say people want change done with them, not change done to them, that still puts the onus on the people leading the change. And I'd say to the folks who are listening here who might not feel they have a direct leadership role in the change, one of the ways that change with you happens is you step up and you engage in the change. Like it's partly it's there's mutual responsibility here. Both parties need to step forward to say we're co-creating this. So there's an immediate invitation to say, and I'll put it really bluntly, stop being a victim of the change that's being imposed on you, but ask yourself to what needs to be true for this to feel like change is being done with me, not the change being done to me. What needs to be true at my end around that? You can't control everything. You know, you can't control their side of the table, but you can control your side of the table. And there's probably more control and probably more influence than you can do that might make that happen. Then in terms of how do you navigate that tricky boss or that tricky senior person, whatever, where I go to is some of the insights from the How to Work with Almost Anyone book, which is to say, so thanks for setting me up there. I like how you lobbed a softball across the net to me. I appreciate that. So the core insight from that book is how we work together is a greater influence, has a greater impact on your success and your happiness, really, than what you're working on. You know, the quality of your working relationships really drive happiness and success. But most of us don't do much about that. Most of us just hope we've got a boss that doesn't suck and hope that we have a team that we like. And sometimes you get lucky and sometimes you get unlucky. But I think you can be a bit more active in terms of how you manage those relationships, and taking responsibility for your side of managing that can be really powerful. And, you know, the core tactic that I recommend is this idea of a keystone conversation, a conversation about how we work together, not what we're working on. So I'll give you an example. My niece, Tilly, has just arrived from Australia. She's 23 and she's interning with me for a month. I'm excited about it. She's excited about it. But we're only 3 days into it. So, of course, we're still excited about it. We're in the honeymoon period around it. She wants to learn how to bring ideas to market. And I've done that in various contexts. We sat down before we got going and said, who are you at your best? That's the first question. It's like, I mean, I don't know that. I know Tilly as a niece, but I don't really know her as a young woman, a young adult, somebody who's working. What do you like when you're at your very best? And then I told her what I'm like when I'm at my very best. Then we talked about when you've had bad bosses, when you've had frustrating working relationships, what happened? What did you do and what did they do to make it so difficult? And then when you've had really good working relationships, what happened? What happened when things really flourished? What did you do? What did they do to really make it flourish? And we also talked about how will we fix it when things go wrong? Because we know over 4 weeks, it's almost inevitable that there'll be some weirdness, some disagreement, some sort of bumping into each other. And we're really committed to maintain a good uncle-niece relationship above and beyond the working relationship that we're just creating. So I do think one of the things to come back to your question, David, is like, how do you do things differently with your boss? Well, one of the things to do is find a way to have a conversation with her to say, look, what can we do to build a better working relationship? How can, when you've had a really great employee working for you, what happened? What did they do? What did I do? Because I'd like to be that employee. Now, let me tell you when I've had a really great boss and I've worked for them. Let me tell you what that is, because I think you'd like to be a really good boss to me. And I'd like you to be a really good boss. And that focus on how will we work together beyond the work itself lays the foundation for a refined and improved working relationship.
And you can take that to the next level. Once you get that basic foundation set, you can say, okay, now what do we do in the context of when something doesn't work the way we hoped? And
exactly.
You get data that contradicts whatever our hope was. How will we address that? What will we do with it? And, yeah. And so on. So you do that beforehand, and now you've got a good framework in place.
Exactly. As the old saying goes, we don't rise to the challenge. We sink to the level of our systems and our preparation. And what you're doing here is you're raising the thing. So when the small experiment fails and you get some disappointing data, you actually already know what sort of conversation you're going to be having with your boss because you pre-planned that.
And that is a very practical, concrete way that you help build the capacity that Michael's been talking about at each of these levels. Imagine in your organization if those conversations are happening at every leader and employee level. And that is a fantastic final thought on a podcast devoted to human-centered leadership. Michael, that was a great way for us to wrap up. Really appreciate it.
Hey, I've got a question for you before you wrap up.
Oh, of course, of course.
When you say working without losing your soul, what do you mean by soul?
Yeah. So, you know, the premise of the podcast is started many, many years ago when our first book that Karen and I wrote together called Winning Well, A Leader's Guide to Getting Results, or Manager's Guide to Getting Results Without Losing Your Soul. And what we meant by that is the frustration, bitterness, and burnout that happens to so many managers and leaders because of all of the different complexities of the workplace, right? That people, as you said, dang it, they're not doing what I asked, right? Let's start with that basic one. But then you get this tension between results and relationships that exists in every leader's pantheon, and the whiplash of running back and forth between those things. Or so how do you synthesize that? So that's what we mean with without losing your soul.
I really appreciate how you do
all this.
I mean, I just think I just assume organizations are on the trajectory to dehumanize the people that are working for them. It's not personal. It's just the nature of an organization. So one of the most powerful things you can do as a manager, a leader, a human being, is to keep fighting for the humanness of the experience. And I know that's what the two of you stand for and what this podcast is about. And that's kind of one of the reasons we connect on this sort of work, because it's like, how do we keep... how does work become a place to bring out people's best, not to lose their sense of humanity, lose their soul?
Exactly. Couldn't have said it better. Michael Bungay Stanier, thank you so much for being a guest today. I really appreciate you sharing your wisdom, the time. I mean, I could talk about this stuff literally for the next couple of hours, but listener, I'm sure that you are now done with your
commute. We could have probably done a 5-hour podcast on this, and it would have been exciting for us. But maybe
it would be exciting for us, but I think our listeners have either got to work, are off their treadmill, or are ready for this to wrap up. So we got to say goodbye.
Yeah.
All right, Michael, it's been a pleasure. And listener, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any of these practical communication skills to help you accelerate your team's performance, reduce stress, and build a career with the respect and influence you deserve. Our guest again today, Michael Bungay Stanier. You're going to find his podcast, any podcast platform is going to have it for you, The Change Signal. Brilliant show. You'll get a lot more on this from a lot more folks, and Michael, of course. And finally, I want to say thank you, as always, to our producer and sound engineer, Brooke Bradford at Sheep and Space Digital Business Services, and Laura at Brooke Marketing, for their work making this episode happen. Until next time, I'm your host, David Dye, along with our guest, Michael Bungay Stanier, reminding you to be the leader you'd want your boss to be.
Thanks, everybody.